Well, we're nearing the end of our studies in this wonderful Old Testament book, the book of Ecclesiastes. And you know it's a positive, upbeat book, this book. I know it's not much. In fact, why are we spending such time in a depressing book? It's because God has given us a message to the world, that unless you turn to God, all you can expect is futility and despair, and life itself is truly meaningless, which is a phrase Solomon uses over and over in this book. Life without God is absolutely depressing, but there's another way, and that's the message we bring. There's another way, the path that leads beyond the shadows of life to a living reality of God leading us through. And as we look at Ecclesiastes, I'm looking for principles behind these verses, not just verses per se, but what's the principles, and then expanding on those and applying them. This section, beginning with the last two verses of chapter 8, marks the last of four major divisions in the book of Ecclesiastes. And from here to the end of the book, the author really doesn't bring us anything new. He simply repeats and enlarges upon the claims which he's made all along, that the significance of life is found only in a daily contact with our living God. In this section, he would remind us that we're to take life as it comes and try not to understand everything about it. Here he gives us good reasons for not trying to solve all the problems and answer all the questions that life throws at us, no matter how much we want to. And so we'll be moving kind of quickly through the chapters of 9, 10, and portion of 11. But we'll start here with the last two verses of chapter 8. In my search for wisdom, and in my observation of people's burdens here on earth, I have discovered that there is ceaseless activity day and night. I realize that no one can discover everything that God is doing under the sun. Not even the wisest people discover everything, no matter what they claim. See, life is too complicated, too vast, too filled with conflicting parts for any of us to figure out all the answers. And we might even try to stay up day and night trying to think through and understand the complicated events that are happening in our lives, but we will never fully understand them. So number one, we need to think about the twists and the turns of life biblically. So chapter 9, verse 1, this too I carefully explored. Even though the actions of godly and wise people are in God's hands, no one knows whether God will show them favor. In the chapters before, we've seen that prosperity is not always a sign that God is particularly happy with you. Even the wicked prosper sometimes. We've also seen that adversity, on the other hand, is not always a sign you're being punished by God either. Sometimes the timing may look odd, and yet it's actually good. The book of Job is proof of that. Job's three tormentors, whom he called his friends, were convinced that what was happening to him was a sign that God was angry with him because he was a sinner, and he must have done something really, really bad to have this kind of really, really poor judgment. But by the end of the book, it's clear that they are totally wrong in all of that. Sometimes they do, but suffering and personal problems don't always come as a result of God disapproving of things in our lives. So again, we must learn to live with mystery. Sometimes problems occur just at the right time. Back a couple years ago, Dorothy Fletcher, who'd been on her way from Britain to her daughter's wedding in Florida, had a heart attack in the air. And she was lucky, however, so when the cabin attendant asked, is there a doctor on board, there happened to be 15 heart specialists all bound for a medical conference in Florida on that plane. You can imagine the surprise as 15 doctors jump up for the request. She was at the right place at the right time. It may have been inconvenient, but she couldn't have been in a safer spot right there with 15 specialists there. We're not smart enough. We don't see enough. We don't understand enough. None of our vaunted technological equipment will answer all the questions. Eventually, we have to agree with God's words. In Isaiah 55, verse 8, it says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways. Verse 1 through 6 is a section which the searcher, as he calls himself, confronts death as the ultimate mystery of life. This is, again, a rather gloomy section. In reading through this book, you may have noted that the author seems to be preoccupied with the thought of death more than we would want to. We're not used to that today. We live at a time when people are busily trying to forget about death, busy trying to make themselves more youthful, trying to hold on to their life. We've devised all kinds of means by which we can temporarily at least maintain the illusion that life goes on and on and on forever. But the scriptures are very honest and realistic about life and death. And so they frequently face the issue. We see that in this passage. Verse 2, the same destiny ultimately awaits everyone, whether righteous or wicked, good or bad, ceremonially clean or unclean, religious or irreligious. Good people receive the same treatment as sinners, and people who make promises to God are treated like people who don't. It seems so wrong that everyone under the sun suffers the same fate. Already twisted by evil, people choose their own mad course, for they have no hope. There's nothing ahead but death anyway. Now, this is not saying that there's no afterlife at all, but it's discussing with the Israelites what is necessary to know with the pagan religions around them. See, religions around Israel thought that the afterlife was another world that we could sometimes contact, and the spirits from the other world would be able to talk to us as well. And the ancient Egyptians would load up their pharaoh's tomb with what? With gold and implements, their concubines, their servants, their animals would all be buried alive with the pharaoh. And why is that? So that he could be whisked into the next world with everything he needed to have joy. But that's not what the Bible says. His statement here basically is that death is the great equalizer. It doesn't matter how righteous you are, how old you are, what gender you are, what race you are, where you're living, what you're doing. Death is going to come to all. Death is the great proof that there's something wrong about humanity. There's something wrong with where we are. Verse 4 says, there is hope only for the living. As they say, it was better to be a live dog than a dead lion. The living at least know they'll die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, nor are they remembered. Whatever they did in their lifetime, loving, hating, envying, it's all long gone. They no longer play a part in anything here on earth. Now, this was written long before pets, you know, or Fido and all of that were domesticated, and the dogs were at the bottom of the animal social scale, with lions the top. When people die, they cannot return. So all the glamour, all the joy, the satisfaction, the peace and happiness that this life can afford is forever ended once we leave it. So if we're going to get anything out of life, if our present existence is to have any meaning at all, it must be found now. And that's what Solomon is arguing. Do not waste your life. Don't run after every exciting experience, every empty pleasure that life may throw at you. Use life to its fullest. Fill it to the full. Discover its purpose now. For whatever meaning life have, it must be found right now. And secondly, we need to respond to the twists and turns of this life biblically. Once again, the searcher comes to the conclusion, which he's reached over and over and over in this book. But he expresses so fully here in these verses. Verse 7, so go ahead. Eat your food with joy, and drink your wine with a happy heart, for God approves of this. Wear fine clothes with a splash of cologne. Live happily with the woman you love through all the meaningless days of life that God has given you under the sun. The wife God gives you is your reward for all your earthly toil. Whatever you do, do well, for when you go to the grave, there will be no work or planning or knowledge or wisdom. As I do marital counseling many times, someone will bring up, or often somebody will bring up this verse, that the wife God gives you is your reward. And it's usually the female who brings that up for some reason. Number 3, we need to respond to the rejection of wisdom biblically and realistically. Verse 11, I have observed something else under the sun. The fastest runner doesn't always win the race, and the strongest warrior doesn't always win the battle. The wise sometimes go hungry. The skillful are not necessarily wealthy. And those who are educated don't always lead successful lives. It's all decided by chance, by being in the right place at the right time. People can never predict when hard times might come. Like fish in a net or birds in a trap, people are caught by sudden tragedy. Verse 11 bursts our bubble. In the King James, you may know it better. The race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. Say it isn't so. It reminds me of a Peanuts cartoon, and after losing yet another baseball game, Charlie Brown complains, it's not fair. How can we lose when we're so sincere? It's unpredictable. It's an imperfect world. Natural effort and ability offer us no guarantee of success. We're not sure what awaits us around the corner. Many of us have had experiences that confirm this fact. All our carefully laid plans have fallen apart. All our dreams that we had when we and took to succeed in some particular area of life crumbled. We couldn't understand why that was. We had to learn, as this text says, that the battle is not always to the strong, nor the race to the swift. What the searcher is saying, of course, is that life is not in our control. Just when you think you have something under control, it does what? It falls apart. Disaster can come when we least expect it, like fish in a net or birds in a trap. Everything can fall apart. But even though disaster may strike, it can still be turned into victory. He has an example to give us in verse 13. Here's another bit of wisdom that has impressed me as I've watched the way our world works. There was a small town with only a few people, and a great king came with his army and besieged it. A poor, wise man knew how to save the town, and so it was rescued. But afterward, no one thought to thank him. So even though wisdom is better than strength, those who are wise will be despised if they're poor. What they say will not be appreciated for long. Now, there's no record of this actually happening in Scripture. Perhaps Solomon heard of this from a delegation from another country, or maybe even he created it as an illustration of the principle. Regardless, God's wisdom can turn what looks like sure defeat into victory for our lives. Although his wisdom may not even be remembered, may not even be popularly rejected at the time and be considered the ultimate foolishness. And there follows in this next section a tremendous contrast between wisdom and foolishness. Verse 17, better to hear the quiet words of a wise person than the shouts of a foolish king. The insights of Scripture, heard in the inner self, quietly before God, God alone, are way more effective to solve problems than all the worldly propaganda, better than the ideas of some well-known opinion maker who says things that are popularly received, but they're contrary to what God says in His Scriptures. Verse 18, better to have wisdom than weapons of war, but one sinner can destroy much that is good. And goes on to say in the very next verse, which is 10:1, as dead flies cause even a bottle of perfume to stink, so a little foolishness spoils great wisdom and honor. We borrowed a figure of speech from this verse as well, the fly in the ointment, right? A warning is included here. Sin is like a dead fly in the perfumer's ointment, which can give off only a very, very bad odor. And one person insisting on following the world's ideas, the world's values, the world's philosophy, can often harm or stop or even destroy the healing work that wisdom brings. Verse 2, a wise person chooses the right road. A fool takes the wrong one. You can identify fools just by the way they walk down the street. In the King James and the NIV, it says the heart of the wise inclined to the right, but the heart of the fool to the left. I'm not sure why that's not maybe a key verse in support of the Republican Party or something. I don't know, but dumb comments are made by famous people. I'm not going to name them because of these dumb comments, but a very, very well-known basketball player had visited Greece, and he was asked if he had visited the Parthenon, and he said, I can't really remember the names of the clubs we went to. Or this was a presidential candidate from the 60s. I've read about foreign policy, and I've studied, and I now know the number of continents. Now, this is a popular singer even today. Whenever I watch TV and I see those poor, starving kids all over the world, I can't help but cry. I'd love to be skinny like that, but not with all those flies and death and stuff. Yeah. And here's a basketball player. We all get heavier as we get older because there's a lot more information in our heads.
Yes.
Yeah. Sure. This is a senator from a very well-populated state. Those who survived the San Francisco earthquake say, thank God I'm still alive. But of course, those who died, their lives will never be the same again. An ex-police chief and mayor of Philadelphia, the streets are safe in Philadelphia. It's only the people who make them unsafe in the city of Philadelphia.
I agree.
This one was a famous car maker. We've got to pause and ask ourselves, just how much clean air do we actually need anyway? Here's a former U.S. vice president. I used to be the future president of the United States. As it turned out, he was wrong with that. But and then this one I'll name because it's been a while. Thomas Watson, the chairman of IBM in 1943. So this is not that long ago, but 1943, IBM. I think there's a world market for at tops maybe 5 computers. People say dumb things and show themselves off. Another contrast, wisdom is better than running away. Verse 4, if your boss is angry at you, don't quit. Yeah, okay. A quiet spirit can overcome even great mistakes. There are occasions when running away, getting out of it, if you will, looks like the best thing to do, but this text warns us that it's actually not. It's often much wiser to give a soft answer that turns away wrath, or to acknowledge another person's feelings and rights instead of our own. And then verse 5 to 7, we have the opposite of this, the hurt that foolish thinking can cause. There's another evil I've seen under the sun. Kings and rulers make grave mistake when they give great authority to foolish people and low positions to people of proven worth. I've even seen servants riding horseback like princes and princes walking like servants. An error that people in authority, and often in government for some reason, is that they appoint their incompetent friends to office, while those with great abilities are treated like slaves and have no opportunity whatsoever. You know, I'm thinking, for instance, in the White House, president after president after president, there's no one single president that comes to mind, but the Lincoln bedroom, the bedroom that Lincoln slept in, is often used to share with donors, large donors, to their election efforts. Also, ambassadors are often appointed to very little-known countries based, again, on their friendship or on their donations to that particular candidate. And then in the next section, verses 8 to 11, returns to wisdom to describe the kind of insights that wisdom will bring. First, there's a section on avoiding dangers, understanding that certain situations have inherent dangers. Verse 8, when you dig a well, you might fall in. When you demolish an old wall, you could be bitten by a snake. When you work in a quarry, stones might fall and crush you. Mm-hmm. You ever try to dig a pit for somebody to take them down? Lay a trap maybe to embarrass them or make them look bad, only to find out you yourself were trapped in the very situation you designed? Wisdom understands that when you dig a pit for someone, you too are in danger of falling in it. Wisdom understands when you try to break down some wall of obstruction that keeps from getting at someone or something, you're in danger, for hidden in that wall could be a serpent that will bite you. He may get what he wants, but it'll be the worst thing that could happen to him. The idea is that care must be exercised to do the things that may endanger you as well. Verse 10, when you chop wood, there's danger with each stroke of your axe. Using a dull axe requires great strength, so sharpen the blade. That's the value of wisdom. It helps you succeed. You don't think through what you're going to do or what you're going to say. If you don't think what you're going to do and sharpen the edges of your approaches, thinking carefully how you're going to do something, you will only expend a lot of effort and find yourself worn out in the process. But the wise man understands the need for sharpness, understands the need for clarity, will sharpen the edge of his thought before he attempts to do something or say something and so succeed. Verse 11, if a snake bites you before you charm it, what's the use of being a snake charmer? Solomon's encouraging us to go for help before it's actually needed. Seek the counsel of one who can diffuse the situation, one who can calm the serpent that's within all of us before we get into trouble. Verse 12, see, it sets forth the dangers of foolish talking. Wise words bring approval, but fools are destroyed by their own words. How tragically this has been illustrated in the lives of those who act according to the world's standards. They end up broken and hurting, wretched, miserable, defiled, empty, and lonely. All the increasing misery and anguish of life that we see all around us is due to a deliberate turning away from the wisdom of the mind of God. All it does is consume and destroy. Verse 13. Fools base their thoughts on foolish assumptions, so their conclusions will be wicked madness. They chatter on and on. Read the papers and well, there are no papers anymore. Watch TV news channels, and you will see the illustrations. People are starting to try to express themselves in a very simple way, but the situation escalates until they resort to violence, even murder. That's the power of foolishness. Verse 14, no one really knows what's going to happen. No one can predict the future. There never was such a day in which people were so bombarded with words and literature and much pouring out of words through the media as today. And yet so much of it is thoroughly empty, it's misleading, and it is unsatisfying. You spend hours looking at TV and reading magazines or whatever. You're not fed, you're not satisfied, you're not strengthened or helped. You feel empty, lonely, and depressed. Verse 15, fools are so exhausted by a little work they can't even find their way home. The scriptures tell you that in every situation where you're looking for guidance, there's a step to take and something you can do that is right. If you do that right thing, another step will open up and then another, and soon you'll find there's a divine hand that's guiding you step by step through the situation. So we're going to close right now with three ways we should live. How should then should we live? Number one, we ought to live supportively. Verse 16, what sorrow for the land ruled by a servant, the land whose leaders feast in the morning. Happy is the land whose king is a noble leader, whose leaders feast at the proper time to gain strength for their work and not get drunk. The point of all this is in the next two verses, which tell those who are seeking to be wise with the wisdom of God how to react when the government is, and determine whether the government is good or bad. What should we do? And here's a couple of proverbs that he brings in here. It's kind of interesting that we know it's Solomon because he really loves proverbs so much. And he wrote that book. Ecclesiastes 10, verse 18, laziness leads to a sagging roof. Idleness leads to a leaky house. And here the searcher compares the nation to a house. A people who are given over to industrious hard work are laying the foundation for steadiness in a government, no matter where the leaders are taking or what the leader is like. Without that foundation of hard work and readiness to work, the roof falls in, the house leaks. Then a nation is insecure and subject itself to destruction or invasion. Verse 19, a party gives laughter, wine gives happiness, and money gives everything. The idea is that money supplies everything that is needed, and money comes again from hard work. Today's feelings of some kind of entitlement notwithstanding, the way to enjoy the normal pleasures of life, as well as the way the nation keeps strong and keeps healthy, is for its people to be willing to work, not to have money and things handed out to them always. Verse 20, never make light of the king, even in your thoughts, and don't make fun of the powerful, even in your own bedroom, for a little bird might deliver your message and tell them all that you said. There, right there, is, I'm sure, the origin of the popular saying, a little birdie told me, right?
Big brother right there, right?
And big brother. It clearly reflects the modern proverb that even the walls have ears. In Ecclesiastes chapter 11, we'll leave for next week as we close out the book of Ecclesiastes. But again, it's important to realize that the reason this book was written was Solomon's attempt to lead us into wisdom and away from folly and foolishness. And the way to do that is not to walk under the sun. Remember that phrase he uses over and over and over again. Under the sun, meaning without God. That only leads to folly, only leads to foolishness. But it's wisdom, true wisdom, is to follow God. Follow his plans for your life, and you will be wise indeed. Let us pray.